has actually defined for itself. Look, Islam says the values are absolute, not relative.
Okay.
It means that if something is bad, so it is bad forever. Mm-hmm. And if it is good, it is good, and it has to be praised and respected. But but in the other schools, as I said earlier, they just look at a social aspect of it. They say, for example, this might be bad in a society, committing such an action might be bad in a society, but as for me, as a person, I practice it. It's because I'm free. Mm-hmm. So you see, this is the difference. Yeah. When you have no limitation for you, but we have these limitations defined by whom? By the Creator.
Okay.
Let me give you an example. When a car actually is going to be given from a company to a person who has recently bought it, what happens? The car actually has been tuned based on some orders and some formulas, and you cannot say that I can take this car everywhere.
So different parts are assembled by the factory and given to you as a car.
So the vehicle cannot be used in any way you like.
The person
who made this car knows how to actually put
assemble
the parts
yes.
together, right?
Yes. Yes.
The car itself has no idea for what has been actually. So the
you as a driver has no idea what's happening mechanically speaking inside the car. Okay.
So the one who has created you actually gave you a formula for your life, and he knows how to live very well in this world. So he is the creator. He knows as the person who made this person.
So now the question would be that, so this ideal system that you are talking about, Islamically speaking, might be practiced well at the time of its true practitioners, I mean, prophets and the infallible imams. But what about now?
So
I mean, the value system that you say can govern the people and has a system of values for the people in order to give them their roles and rights in the society must be, in a better sense, be practiced by its true practitioners. I mean, at the time of Prophet Muhammad and the infallible imams. So what about now? Because the type of...
Islam as a program has not been actually revealed for a certain period of time.
I know.
It has been revealed for the whole mankind for in the course of history till the end of the day.
This is true. The value system is the same. But you know, extracting the new rules from that and adapting
so
it to
even Islam
the modern
is
day.
Open in this sense. Okay. Look, up until the time of, for example, imams, those who were present, so they were the real interpreters of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of the Qayba and occultation of Imam alayhi salam, there is the solution of ijtihad is open. And the ijtihad is something which is dynamic, and it is available every time. So those who are ruwat al-hadith, those who are interpreters of hadith from the language of Ahlul Bayt, those who are calling them general deputies of imam, they are eligible to interpret the hadith for the day that we are in.
Mm-hmm.
So they can easily actually interpret and give us the laws based on the Islamic values. And so
also, can I add a point
yes.
to that, though?
Yes,
now, what you mentioned is that you saying, okay, Islam is a system and needs someone to maintain it.
Yes.
So you kind of trying to imply the fact that we constantly need an imam or a prophet to maintain it.
Yes.
Now, with Islam, there are two sides to it. Now, there is the government side where you have, you know, Allah appoints the ma'sumin or the infallibles or the governors of the system. But the system itself, it was made very clear to the followers of that system that you as a person has what we call wajibat, right? You have got compulsory actions that you need to abide by whether you have someone governing or not. So, for example, now, whether the imam is present or not, whether even the deputies are present or not, as a Muslim, I have certain things. For example, you know, if we go by the Ten Commandments, thou I shall not kill, right?
Yes.
Thou shall not steal. These are set laws. I don't need...
Mm-hmm.
An imam. I don't need someone to be in government to tell me this is my obligation.
Okay.
So Islam says you have certain obligations.
Okay.
Now, with other things, you might need to, you know, things to be explained to you and stuff like that. But the main things that when it comes to the rights of people, dealing with other people, they're all just set, predefined. Everyone knows them.
That's right.
Whether it is an imam or not. So Islam itself, so you can say it's self-maintained when it comes to the person himself. So now I know my duties.
Yeah.
Now sometimes, we can say when it comes to matters of new affairs and things like that and how I should deal with them in terms of halal haram, maybe I have to refer to a marja, I have to refer to an imam.
Okay.
But the basics themselves, they are set.
So then we
so
have
for example, if we do a comparison between Islam and the secular system or the countries that we have. For example, Islam from the beginning said there is no difference between a black man and a white man.
Yes.
From the beginning.
Yes.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala eliminate that kind of level between people.
Yes.
Now we still have that problem in the West, for example, black people and white people. Yes. Until today, the 21st century.
Yes.
So as a Muslim, back if I go back 1,000 years ago, my values are set in this kind of regard. So we don't constantly need that kind of government.
That's right.
Yes, it, as part of Islam needs that kind of government, but initially saying that as a person, me and you, our duties are set and clear.
Only for the new problems on Masa'il al-Mustahdath.
Exactly. So but Muslim, he knows that he should not kill, he should not take the rights of others, he should not steal. He's that set.
But you see, we have so many problems in the Muslim lands because there are so many interpretations out of a same fixed value system among different schools of thoughts. You know, the problem is here that the in the West, in the secular system, as we call it, democracy or the republic, the system of the law is replaced with the religious one, so the separated church and the state, okay? And that's the law that is ruling over the country. In the Muslim lands, in the Islamic schools of thought, now we have different interpretations out of the same system of the value. And still, the people are not ruling over the people. I mean, people from the same classes. Still, there is a government because, politically speaking, the system of the government and these political different political positions are coming from the Western political sciences. Mm. And then we want to annex or cling a kind of Islamic value system to that so they do not come together. Still, the people are now ruling over the people, as you see in the Persian Gulf. You know, in the Arab countries, there's still the aristocratic king system over there, ruling over the people, okay, in the Muslim lands. In Islamic Republic of Iran, we have this republic that the everybody's vote is counted, okay? It's not like representative elect in the U.S. or something like that. The elites of the society decide for the people. But still, we have the problem of how to interpret this value system as close as possible to the pure Muhammadan Islam.
I think, I'm not sure if the brother agrees. I think you're mixing so many things together, with all due respect.
Yes.
You're putting so many things together, and I think you're drifting out of the topic altogether. Now, when it comes to interpreting certain laws and certain values by Muslims, that's a topic by itself.
Okay.
Defining government and what a government
as you said, Brother Abdullah,
that's a different topic.
Brother Sayyid Abdullah, as you said, Islam is self-sufficient.
Yeah.
This
is what I'm saying to you. Okay, this is what I'm trying to say to you. Is like, as a Muslim now, the main theme of Islam, the main lifestyle that is set, that is not something that me and you disagree on. For example, the brother has said in the Quran, whoever kills one soul, as if he killed entire humanity.
Yes.
That's not subject to interpretation. Everyone knows it. I should not kill.
Yes.
Now, when it comes to interpretation, people say, well, okay, the Quran says kill those who are non-Muslims, for example.
Yes.
And they interpret that in their own sense and they go blow themselves up.
The takfir ones.
Okay, takfir ones. Yes. Now, these guys, okay, they might have went through away from the formula, but the formula itself is set. Mm-hmm. Now, these people who misinterpret, they're only misinterpreting for their own agenda, not because there's a problem in the system itself to begin with.
Okay.
Now, I can misinterpret the Quran or the Hadith in any way I like to suit me.
Yes.
Not that there's something wrong with it. So the majority of the Muslims, they agree killing a person is wrong.
Yes.
Now, Daesh, no matter how, like 10,000, 15,000, 100,000 of them, compared to 1.6 billion, is nothing. So I can't disagree with the majority and take the minority. So even with being misinterpretation, I'm going to overlook it. But the theme itself is there.
Yeah, a brief comment on the Sayyid's explanation. A brief comment, I think. We have to go one step before your question. Mm-hmm. What do I mean? Look, we are defining the principles and fundamentals in Islam. But we are not talking about masadiq, or examples which are actually practical in Islam world.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't care, for example, in that Arab country, for example, due to hierarchy or due to their dynasty, the rule of that country has been actually given to a person, right?
Okay.
So what I'm saying, what Islam says, Islam.
No, I mean, brother.
And Islam defined, mind you, brother, cut you off. Yeah, Islam defined what a ruler should be. And he gave the characteristics and the virtues of a ruler.
Yeah.
Now, if the people choose a wrong ruler, or a ruler comes by power, now me and you as Muslims, we are powerless to do anything about it. Especially if these systems are supported by the West themselves.
Yeah. If he inherited, for example, from his dynasty, a kind of government, so it is not going to be necessarily a model, Islamic model. Islam has its own principle, and it has not changed from 14th century ago, and it has been defined by the Prophet and explained by the Imams.
So, in this school, we are talking about, you talked about the Masadiq, I mean, these examples. Now, if in a Muslim land, which is ruled by an Islamic system of value, if there comes a problem about the rights of the people, what is the problem? Where is the problem coming from? You're claiming to have rule the country by a system of values which is rooted in Islam. Mm-hmm. Is it so?
Yeah.
So in comparison to the Western world, which have so many problems, I believe that. But as long as you are comparing yourself with them, and then you as a Muslim land have many problems.
We're not comparing
some people say upon this conspiracy theory, these are all, you know, the plots against the Muslim lands. You know, the system of the governance coming from over there into the Muslim lands mixed with some Islamic themes and the concepts and then rule over the people. But it's still so many Muslim lands nowadays have crisis. Where do these problems come from, brother?
Actually, we are not comparing Islam to any other school because it has al-Islam ya'lu wa la ya'la. Al-Islam, this is not good. Sorry, delete it. Islam is high and we're not comparing Islam to any other school. Rationally speaking, we are saying that, look, this is the formula that Islam has given us for the, system of government.
Mm-hmm.
But if it is not being observed in this country or in the other, so lots of problems will arise. So the same way that they have selected their own government, they have to go and solve their problems.
So another way, you're saying, do not blame this Islamic system. Blame those who apply it.
There's a problem in
applying it, not in the system itself. So. Yeah. Me as a ruler, I know that my Islamic duties, but I decide to be a corrupt person and take the rights of other peoples. Now, someone from the outside, they can't come and blame Islam because I'm in a Muslim country, I'm a Muslim person, and say, okay, here's your ruler, here's Islam, you guys doing it wrong. Well, I am doing it wrong, not Islam.
Yeah,
I know. Even now in the West, when they point fingers at Islam, they measuring Islam by the people. You can't do that. You know how Imam Ali says,
the wrong practitioners,
know the truth,
I know, yes.
You know the people of the truth.
Yeah.
Not vice versa. So now people say, well, okay, look at the Muslim countries. Well, I don't care about the Muslim countries. I don't care who rules the Muslim countries.
Yes.
They do not represent Islam.
Okay, that's right. Thank you very much for today's discussion. It was really nice. Sayyid Abdullah Musa and Brother Ali, we are out of time for today's discussion.
Thanks.
We have to cut it over here. Thank you very much. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. For listening to this program, this is We Points. I'm Atta, the host of this program. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Khalaf Islam page. Also, YouTube channel, Instagram page, Khalaf Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah. The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are going through various sermons of Imam Ali alayhi salam, where we can receive some inspiration from them to fill us in this topic, to tell us about what the Islamic civilization is, and how it has to be, and what it has done for mankind, and what it can still do for the grandeur of mankind, what it can do for the progress of the societies and for the Muslim people of the world. Amongst the phrases that Imam Ali alayhi salam talks to us about in the sermon number 87 in Nahjul Balagha, he says that one of the situations that the communities before Islam faced, which can repeat now and at any time, and which shows how much the communities need Islam, is that Imam Ali says, وَانْتِشَارٍ مِّنَ الْأُمُورِ, that at those times before the coming of Islam, the communities had scattered efforts, the efforts towards good, the efforts towards progress were scattered, were sporadic, were disintegrated. But then he goes on to say, وَتَلَظِّمْ مِّنَ الْحُرُوبِ, and one of the problems of those times was that they were always, uncovered in wars and fighting.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that before the coming of Islam, the communities were facing a problem. And that problem was that they were always indulged in fighting and war. The fever of war, the heat of battle, those were the things that defined what societies were. The Persian Empire, on one hand, they would take up their arms and their heroes would come forward and their wrestlers would come forward to fight. And fighting and war was the actual value at that time. On the other hand, the Roman Empire was the same, if not worse. They would also have their soldiers, their gladiators, their armies, their weapons, their advanced weaponry. They would come, they would fight. And these wars were being fueled by these, these people, these power-hungry people that wanted to maintain their clutches on the society. That fear was what was allowing them to continue their leadership and their rulership. They were feeding the thirst. They were feeding the thirst in the people to continuously want territory, to continuously want to overcome another nation. That thirst was being fed, was being caused to thrive by these leaders and these communities, to allow that state of fighting and war to continue. And this was something that is in history. If we look at the books of history, it is clear as daylight that this was happening. This was happening not only in the Arabian Peninsula itself, where if you look at history, the Arabs, the tribes between the Arabs, the Aus and the Khazraj, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran that they were always fighting and they were about to, get completely destroyed in this world and in the hereafter. Not only the Arabian Peninsula, but around the Arabian Peninsula, as I said, the Roman and the Persian empires were just engrossed in these wars. It was about blood. Life was about the sword, was about shedding blood. And this was actually a big reason why these communities did not have true progress.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَتَلَظِّمْ مِنَ الْحُرُوبِ. That means they were always engrossed, engulfed, indulging in wars and fighting. Just like how a thirsty person, is turning around in his thirst. When a person is thirsty, like he's really, really thirsty, he's turning around, like he's moving his body in search of water, and that thirst is overcoming and overwhelming him. That is how the communities, unfortunately, were in that state because of war. They wanted to, they were always in the state of fighting, and that state of fighting was turning them into this person who is always thirsty, and just like how a thirsty person kind of, churns around himself, and as if he's in that state of sickness and illness, whereby the heat and the fever of war and the flames of war have engulfed him and have engrossed him. This is how it is even today. Look at the world today and the leaders of the world, the so-called developed world of today. They thrive in the wars that are happening. They are the ones that fund the warring parties. They want to sell their weapons. They want to increase destruction in areas and lands with the intention of finally being able to control those areas. This, don't think that these wars are not liked by them. They want to fight. They want to increase the fighting. They want that those parties to fight one another, because then in that state of destruction and confusion and scatteredness, then they can come and show their faces as peace givers and peacemakers, and kind of come and take that savior mode to come and save the communities in their own ways, in their false opinions. This is something dangerous, and we see that today we are facing those same issues, and therefore we are actually experiencing that state of ignorance, whereby now we realize that, as Imam Ali alayhi salam says, Islam is the one to save us and remove us from this state of corruption. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Economic divide.
What in the world is going on with the world's energy commodities? Why is there such an energy crunch? Like for gas, why are oil prices so high? And if there's such a shortage, why are countries like Iran and Venezuela, who have two of the world's largest oil and gas reserves, restricted by U.S. sanctions? Hi, I'm Kabat Hawaii. Those are some of the topics we'll be covering in this edition of the program. Coming up in today's program, the energy crunch from the west to the east. Natural gas prices to have skyrocketed in Europe, especially the UK, pressuring manufacturers in the US, Europe, and yes, even China. Then let's look at the green energy transformation. Is the world ready for it? Transitioning from sources like coal to green energy? Is failing with coal actually making a comeback? The supply is falling short. Also in this program, we'll be taking a look at Iran's proven oil and gas reserves, 137 billion barrels, 10% of the world's total. It can alleviate global fuel crisis, but wait, U.S. sanctions are preventing that. And such is the case with Venezuela. It's a worldwide energy crunch, and countries around the world are feeling the squeeze, like in the U.S.
It is actually, it's a really big problem, because I mean, gas prices are like about $4 now, and I mean, if somebody makes about $10 an hour, I mean, it's a big problem for them to even fill up their gas tank, because it's like $60,
$65. The United States is contributing to the shortage by not allowing a lot of fracking, by not allowing building of pipeline, so it restricts the supply. If you restrict the supply, prices will be going up. So the United States does its part. It's not the overall most important part.
Even China is feeling the shortage. Affected by various factors, many regions in China have seen tight supply of electricity since September. The situation is grim for the UK, which has been plagued by gas shortages and Brexit woes. Fears of inflation have gripped the U.S., causing investors in Europe to be cautious, especially since the energy crisis is driving up the price of oil.
Ich könnte mir vorstellen, dass der Staat sagt, die hohen Strom- und Gaspreise, Ölpreise, die decken wir zum Teil ab. Wir nehmen also die Spitze raus. Wer finanziert das am Ende? Natürlich die EZB, gemäß ihrem Motto, einer zahlt bestimmt.
Worldwide, citizens are mad, since they are suffering from high prices and inflation as a result of energy shortages and supply chain disruptions.
Vous touchez 600, il y a des personnes âgées qui touchent 600, 700 euros de retraite, des handicapés qui touchent 900 euros. Et vous avez des mamans avec deux enfants.
Il faut travailler aussi pour gagner 200 euros par jour. Moi, personnellement, je loue cette voiture que je paye 100 euros. Alors, dans les 100 euros qui restent, je dois manger, je dois mettre du carburant. Donc ça veut dire que je fais une journée de travail quoi, pour gagner 50 euros.
This transformation to clean energy is also creating a crisis, since the volume of energy does not match the demand side now that many economies are opening up after COVID. With energy prices of the U.S. skyrocketing, shortage of energy in Europe, and China experiencing a shortage as well, the world economic recovery remains in doubt. Unless countries like Iran and Venezuela enter the market and provide the much-needed oil and gas. But U.S. sanctions are preventing that from happening. Once again, U.S. sanctions are affecting citizens of countries worldwide, including its own citizens. One of the things that the world energy crunch can do is to derail the world economic recovery. And naturally, when the economy picks up, there will be more demand for energy. World oil prices can rise, which it has. It can boost oil demand by 500,000 barrels per day, and it could stoke inflation, which, again, it has, in commodities like food.
A warning Thursday from the International Energy Agency. The energy watchdog warns a global energy crunch is likely to boost global oil demand by 500,000 barrels per day, and that's enough to stoke inflation and slow the economic recovery.
Well, the IMF has cut its global growth forecast, with one of the reasons being the world energy shortage.
The global recovery continues, but the momentum has weakened, hobbled by the pandemic. Overall, risks to economic prospects have increased, and policy trade-offs have become more complex. Now, compared to our July forecast, the global growth projection for this year has been revised down marginally to 5.9%. and is unchanged for 2022 at 4.9%.
Well, joining us for this edition of the Q&A is Joe Quinn. He's the lead editor and researcher at SOT.net. He's written articles like his most recent one, Newsreel, Zero Carbon, Zero COVID, The Reckless and Extremist Ideologies at the Heart of the Government. All right, Joe, welcome. The world is facing an energy crunch as the supply of natural gas and coal and other energy sources have failed to adequately satisfy demand. Natural gas prices have risen multifold, as you're aware, while several factories in China even have shut down due to power disruptions. What exactly is going on here?
Well, the first thing that's that's mentioned quite often is the pandemic, you know, and what governments have done over the past 18 months, governments around the world have done over the past 18 months in response to the pandemic, which was to shut down large sections of society, and as a result, reduce demand for many products, and essentially interfered with the global supply chain of many different products, including energy.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
This is our in-depth section, which means it's time to take a deep look at the energy crisis, the big energy crunch. Well, in order to get an idea about the energy crisis, we need to take a look at what types of energy commodities there are in the first place. Well, there you have it. This is a good way of looking at it. We try to cover all of them. You got things like wind and solar, coal, oil, nuclear, hydro, bioenergy, pumped storage, gas and interconnectors, and of course, since we didn't have much room, we put it under other fuels. Well, let's take all of these energy commodities and then get a sense of how much each of them are being used across the world. And this graph is going to give you an idea, because what we did was we took it and we looked at the average median, if you will, to get an idea of its usage overall. So as you can see over here, as this was being formed, the one in orange is gas, which is the most widely used form of usage. You got nuclear and then coal, which come in second and third place, respectively. In terms of coal, that's the one in the black that you see in the bottom here. Now, let's take a look in particular at wind and solar, because there's so much talk about fighting climate change. And of course, that's green energy. You could see that the usage really peaks right around this area over here. Now, that's quite a lot for wind and solar, if you think about it. Although its usage is at the bottom, renewable now provide actually a third of power generation. However, that's still not enough to provide all the energy needs at this time when the global economy is bouncing back from the COVID-19 pandemic. The shortage that is being experienced now is set to be a short-term squeeze, if you want to call it maybe a jolt. After colder than normal winter depleted natural gas inventories, gas and electricity prices soared, as you can see over here. This is actually outlining it. However, this actually is showing what has resulted as a result of gas and energy usage overall, which basically you're looking at inflation. Inflation is soaring across what we use as a barometer with the G7 economies. So you can see the effect that it has there. And that brings us to China. Now, China, believe it or not, has had an energy shortage as a result of all of this. And this graph shows it incrementally. It's going to go, as you can see, pointing to that. The industrial economy still relies heavily on fossil fuels. And, of course, that naturally means coal, gas, and oil. The country simply does not have enough fuel. Why? Because it was trying to transition to cleaner energy to help with the climate crisis. Here is China's power usage, as you can see, showing what I just talked about. Which basically means it needs coal as an example. Now, Chinese manufacturing is something that has happened that is very unusual because of the transition that it was trying to make. It actually contracted in September for the first time. That occurred for the first time in 19 months. And guess what happens when China needs gas, oil, and coal? Well, it's going to hoard up all the energy as much as it can, which, as a result, will affect the rest of the world, like it has done in Europe, because there are tighter energy supplies as a result. And in particular, it has affected the UK. So you can see the effect that China has on the world when it's trying to keep up with the demand that is coming through so that it could have its production ramped up. This is our new section where we will look at social media posts, web entries, viewer comments, and the like, and discuss this with our guests. We hope to have your input so we can feature your comments in our future episodes. Okay, let's get started. When it comes to the world energy shortages, there is a lot at stake for every country. Let's face it, fuel, energy, it all starts from there when it comes to production and everything else, really. But are there politics at play here? Well, let's look at China. In line with transitioning to green energy and fulfilling green commitments, China announced in September 21 that it will stop building coal-burning power plants abroad. That marked a major shift for a country that is heavily reliant on coal. This entry reveals just that. China pledges to stop building coal-burning power plants abroad in a major shift for one of the biggest backers of coal-fired plants globally. Still, China remains heavily reliant on new coal plants at home and is the world's top emitter of greenhouse gas emissions. Well, that was on September 21. Then came October 13. In less than a month, a 360-degree turn, China announces a power problem and said that there is a national rush, that is, to mine and to burn more coal, as the country's electricity shortage threatens to damage its image as a reliable manufacturing base. Okay, so there you have it. Well, let's find out from our guest and see what he thinks. We turn to Joe Quinn. Joe, it seems like China and many like it cannot move away from coal.
In terms of China, China, there's talk in China of moving again away from, I mean, China produces about 50% of its energy supply from coal, and of course the greening of the economy, etc., in the face of climate change is requires countries to move away from burning fossil fuels like coal. But there's simply no way that China is going to move away from to any great extent move away from the burning of coal and oil and gas.
Okay, well, Joe doesn't think that. Well, when we take a look at the reaction from a viewer out there, Fred Jacobs is the one that we picked, a 57-year-old software marketer who lives in Seattle, Washington, in the U.S., who wrote, ordered two high-performance solid-state drives in late summer from China, only to be offered a refund a week ago because of a lack of electricity, which would cause factory delays. Now, doesn't this sound exactly like what the U.S. is actually wishing for? Anything to hurt China's economy? It looks like this was a Christmas gift that came early for the White House. Well, Fred further added, I was flabbergasted because I have heard about shipping issues with China, but not power issues or infrastructure issues with Chinese suppliers. Now the risk is much higher, and I will buy from U.S. vendors, even if I have to pay more. Okay, let's turn to oil now. Prices of oil have skyrocketed. This tweet states that the global energy crisis sends crude oil prices to the highest levels since late 2018, which is around $85 a barrel based on this entry. This shows how the green push is being defeated. Now, there's a viewer by the name of Pisk who has stated in his tweet, as more renewable energy enters the markets and it closes nuclear power, more gas and fuel needs to be burned as the power generated from renewable is marginal. But there are many comments that go actually beyond mainstream news, like this one that came from DMAC. And he wrote, we're assuming that it's a he, that this so-called shortage was planned to manipulate our economy and increase the rate of inflation, that it's a continuation of the last time that Obama and Joe were in office. Just remember the prices the last time around and look at the current gas and power price to have increased. Okay, let's find out what Paolo thinks. Paolo Raffone, what can you say about the global shortage? Any government interference, or should I say manipulation, that's going on here?
Well, the energy crunch is something that could have been foreseen before the COVID, and of course the COVID has increased the possibility that this would have happened, and it did in fact. That the entire system of the globalized supply of energy end goods, in fact, is very fragile. It's very fragile because it is extremely influenced by geopolitical confrontations and instability.
Okay, global agreements. Let's see if that's going to turn out to be the case. So geopolitical factors obviously impact the global energy crunch. By the way, the viewer comment that we mentioned before Paolo Rofone was speaking of, started speaking, which was about gas prices during the time Obama was president and his VP was Biden, to have hit peak prices. Do you think that was true? Well, let's do a flashback and a background check here. And here you have it. This is a snapshot to refresh your memory. The text added to the bottom of the photo reads, just a reminder of what things looked like the last time that Biden was in the White House. Okay, we would like it if you got engaged with us. You can write to us and tell us what you think about anything, especially about the program or topics that you want us to cover. Our links and addresses are here. We would love to hear from you. Now it's time to pass the torch to Mehdi so he can tell you more about the world energy crunch and a realistic solution to the matter, as you're about to find out.
Thank you, Kaveh. The energy crunch has taken the world by surprise, and it seems no country or continent will be immune to it. Take the oil prices. They've touched their highest in almost 7 years. As of the recording of this program, WTI crude oil was selling for a little over $82 per barrel. Natural gas prices were at record high as China was facing shortages coming on the back of global demand. Gas prices in the EU, which imports 90% of its gas, have skyrocketed almost 600% this year. Not that other commodities haven't. One main reason is that inventories at European storage facilities are at historically low levels for this time of year. The EU has blamed Russia for using gas as a political tool, something drawing anger from the Russian President Vladimir Putin. With consumers facing a huge jump in winter fuel bills, energy prices have topped the European Union's political agenda. The EU has presented what it has called a toolbox, short and medium-term measures to help people and businesses get through the winter. These measures include emergency income support to households, state aid for companies, and targeted tax reductions. In one respect, there has been a push to prevent climate change, and this means stopping the use of coal or even nuclear power plants.
It is a serious issue. I think we have to be very clear that the gas prices are skyrocketing, and but the renewables, the prices have decreased over the last years and are stable.
The situation for the UK is grim. If there are rising energy bills this winter, many more Brits can die of the cold in what is known as fuel poverty. Just last year, it was reported that on average, there are 32,000 more deaths between December and March than the rest of the year. An average of 9,700 deaths each year are believed to be caused by living in a cold house.
Every winter, millions of people struggle to heat their homes, and the rising cost of energy just increases the misery.
China, meanwhile, has also been hit by the low energy supplies as it tries to ensure there is enough energy supply across the country this winter and next spring. Many regions in China have seen tight supply of electricity since September. By some accounts, China is in a state of emergency when it comes to oil and gas. So much so that China has ordered state-owned energy companies to do whatever it takes to secure fuel supplies. But China has not sat idle. For example, a chemical company in northwest China's Shaanxi province has pledged to develop the country's energy industry through a green and low-carbon path. Energy shortages, astronomical gas prices, bottlenecks in supply chains. Is there a solution on the horizon? Not just a quick fix, which can address the problem? Sure there is. Iran oil minister has said that sanctions removal will help solve global energy crisis. He said the unprecedented surge in gas prices in Europe was driven by a fall in gas storage levels. All this is happening while Iran has been deprived of exporting its oil for many years. Europeans and Americans are now struggling with such an issue while their governments have long imposed illegal and cruel sanctions against our crude oil exports. Venezuela is another country sanctioned by the U.S. that can fill the worldwide energy shortage. Venezuela has the largest proven oil reserves, and it ranks 8th in the world when it comes to natural gas reserves. So, it looks like the stage is set for an all-out scramble among Asia, Europe, the Middle East, and South America for shipments of LNG from exporters. And this is where countries like Iran and Venezuela can be a good fit for providing the much-needed oil and gas. So, what do you think? Shouldn't the EU and US lift their illegal sanctions? Iran can help their energy needs and the world for that matter. Because this problem is not going away anytime soon. Please write to us and let us know what you think. These are our links and addresses. It's goodbye until next week.
In my final thoughts, I would like to focus first on the supply chain. The supply chain damage could have been a lot less, or even eliminated, were it not for the COVID-19 vaccine greed from the rich countries, like from the G7 countries, who are still hoarding the vaccine, by the way. Many of the links are developing countries, like in Africa maybe or elsewhere, that still need vaccines. Then comes another very important point. The massive energy supplies that can be added to the world supply, but is being prevented from doing so. Why? Because of the U.S. and its sanctions. And, of course, I'm talking about Iran and also Venezuela, who have massive supplies of oil and gas. Imagine if their products were to be poured into the supplies of the world in terms of energy. Well, it doesn't seem like that's going to happen, because the U.S. would rather have its people suffer, have its citizens suffer from inflation, for example, and yet not have oil come from these two countries due to political objectives that it has. That does for this edition of Economic Divide. Your questions and comments are always welcome. It was great to have you. Until next week, it's goodbye.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadali, and you are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss issues, problems, and other questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. As usual, all of the answers and suggestions provided in this program are based upon the Holy Quran, and upon the narrations of the Prophet and of the household of the Prophet, peace be upon them all. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend and guest speaker, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, I welcome you and Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Our topic today is about how we should try at the very least to understand our children. Last we spoke about how children are stimulated by various senses, and it is up to the parent to determine which sense is most prevalent in their child so they may better understand them and help their child develop in a healthy and sound environment. Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه. When it comes to understanding children, there's one important thing also we need to understand, that to every heart, as we say, there's a key, and to every person there's an entrance. And that's not just with children, that's with human beings in general. This, each one of us has something that, you know, as we can consider it to be the key to his heart.
A trigger.
Yeah, a trigger, or at least a way we can get through to them.
Right.
So sometimes you find people, maybe, for example, with children, they might you can get through to them through food, through chocolates and candy and stuff like that.
Right.
Some kids you can get through to them maybe through giving them a gift. Some kids maybe you can get through to them through a nice word. Some people, you can get through to them by just complimenting them and giving them all the required attention, and so on and so forth. So every child would have something that he loves. A good, successful parent or an educator is the one that knows what his child likes and how he could use that in trying to get to him. So sometimes I find out that my child, for example, likes gifts, right?
Right.
And because he likes gifts, so I just keep giving him gifts all the time. That's not a good thing. That's not a right thing.
Right.
Now, I know he likes that, so therefore I should use that in my own, for my own advantage, to get the child, for example, to do things.
Right.
To, I don't know, maybe work with his schoolwork or do more chores or, I don't know, learn something
right.
new by using that method. Or, for example, if you see that the child likes chocolates and candy and this stuff, you say, okay, well, sure, I'll buy you candy, I'll buy you ice cream, this and that.
Right.
If these things are done. So, in a way or another, understanding how the child works and what he likes, it's a way for parents to get to know their children on a personal level. And you can use this as a way of trying to teach and educate their children in the best of ways.
Dear Sayyid, I must unfortunately interrupt you because we are going on a quick break.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are now listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are talking about how we can use the senses that are most prevalent in our children to better understand them and to better build a relationship with them, but also how we can use that as a tool to educate them and make them do chores, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Dear Sayyid, please continue the discussion.
So, first thing we need to do is we need to do an experiment with children and find out what they like and what they don't like and how I can get to the child heart. So that usually happens through a process of experiment, trials, right?
Right.
So sometimes it's the child himself makes it very evident and very easy, the things that he loves, and then you know the way to his heart. Sometimes you don't know. So in that case, you do this kind of experiment, trials, to see which one the child likes. So you can just even ask them a question. Oh, for example, would you like to go out for a picnic, or would you prefer to watch a movie, for example?
Right.
Would you like this, or would you like that? And then, after a while, you get to know which one your child loves the most. And once you know this is what he loves the most, you can use it for your advantage. And then the child would hate to lose such a thing, and he would love to have such a thing.
Right.
So then the child pretty much is in your hand, in your control. And then you can at least direct the child to the to the right path that you want them to be by just knowing how to get to them. So that itself, like I said, it takes time and it requires an experience. It requires a bit of experiment. It requires a bit of trial and error.
Naturally,
to find
yeah.
out what the child likes and what he
right.
wants and what he doesn't want. So from here we say to the parents, it says not just a matter of, an extra thing that you should do. It's actually something that you must do, right? Something that you must understand.